When I first discovered this music about 6 or 7 years ago, I was immediately struck by the fact that it had two of the key symptoms of deeply important music. Number one, it didn't really sound like anyone else's music. And number two, and even more importantly, although it was immediately appealing, the more you got to know this music, the richer and more interesting and more important the music seemed to get. And here is how I was introduced to the music of this composer 6 or 7 years ago. Here are the two nocturnes for string orchestra by the English composer Lionel Sainsbury, played by the strings of the Royal Ballet Sinfonia, led by Gavin Sutherland. The two nocturnes for string orchestra, music from 1990 by Lionel Sainsbury, performed by the Royal Ballet Sinfonia, led by Gavin Sutherland. And like so many composers who are in essence pianists, he writes so well for the strings. I mean, it's one of those wonderful, strange things about composers, writing for, or do you play any string instrument?
No, Jim, no, I don't. And I don't conduct either. But I've written, as you know, quite a lot for strings, and including, obviously, for solo strings as well. I was talking to Lorraine McCaslin recently, the violinist who has recorded my violin concerto, and she was very complimentary about the violin writing in the concerto, being grateful to play, she said. Other string players have made similar remarks, so I must be doing something right.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm an old oboe player, and you write beautifully for that instrument, too. So, I mean, you've actually done your homework when it comes to the various other instruments that you don't play.
Yeah, but I suppose, you know, a lot of composers possibly don't play instruments that they write for.
Yeah, oh, exactly. I think a prime example, the Viennese-born Joseph Horowitz, who does not play anything except the piano. Great wind concertos, great wind writing,
and
superb string writing too. You know, it's amazing. Well, obviously, I have been joined tonight by the English composer Lionel Sainsbury. We're going to be playing his music for the next few hours and talking about whatever he feels like. Lionel Sainsbury, welcome to Classical KUSC.
Thank you very much, Jim. Nice to be here with you.
Well, to ask you, I guess the obvious question, how important, speaking of the violin concerto, has the violin concerto been as your career has unfolded? Because it was certainly the work that made me sit up and take notice.
Well, I think it has been tremendously important, actually. I think a very big break for me, if you like, was when the British conductor Barry Wordsworth took it up, and he recorded it for BBC Radio 3 over here in the UK. And that predated the commercial recording that he later made with the BBC Concert Orchestra. So I think I owe Barry a lot, actually, for that he singled it out and was very determined to do it.
And although it's a piece from 1989, I don't think it's the sort of musical language that anyone with a serious interest in classical music is going to have any trouble absorbing. I mean, we've played it 3 or 4 times on this program, and the next day people phone in and say, what was that you played at 9 o'clock last night, and where can I get it? I hate to use such an awful word in some musical circles, but it is totally accessible.
Well, I'm very pleased to hear that. I mean, I like to think that my work would be accessible to the widest possible audience, really.
Yeah, and of course there was a time in, you know, the waning decades of the last century when composers were not always, or it didn't seem they were always that intent on communicating with other people, if you know what I mean. They seemed to write music designed for other composers to hear and for those lovely people, those 250 people who show up at contemporary music concerts. But this seems to be, in the best possible sense, a throwback to the days when composers deeply wanted to communicate with human beings.
Yeah, well, I think that's what it's all about, isn't it? I really do.
Maybe a word or two about the genesis of the piece, how it came to you, how you began finding your way into this thing.
It was a very long gestation, actually, because it is quite a big piece, as you know. It has the date 1989 on it, because I tend to just be satisfied with the date when I completed something. So it wasn't all written in the year of 1989. It was really started as long before as 1985. And it very much grew from the main slow theme of the slow movement. That was the first idea that I had from which I thought, I think I could make a violin concerto out of this. So the slow movement was actually written first. And I think I went on then to the last movement. And the first movement was the last to be written.
Mm. Yeah, and like, and I'm certainly not the first one to point this out, but like that other great English violin concerto, well, like two of them, as a matter of fact, those of Sir Edward Elgar and Sir William Walton, the center of gravity seems to be in that final movement. It is a big play.
Is. I mean, and obviously those two incredibly great concertos have been a big influence. I've been very, very influenced indeed by Walton in particular, and Walton and Elgar are both, you know, great, great loves of mine.
Mine too. In fact, when people ask me, so who's your favorite composer? I always say, you mean my favorite real composer or Elgar? Because, you know, there's still people who don't realize this is the last great romantic composer. And who further don't realize that it can be argued that the Elgar Fiddle Concerto is the great work in the form. And when I said that to the young Nicola Benedetti, she looked at me like I was nuts and said, well, of course, the Beethoven is. And I said, have you played the Elgar yet? And she said, well, no, not yet. And I said, well, after you've played it a few times, then come back and we'll talk.
Yeah, it's a piece that has just the most profound understanding of the violin. And obviously Elgar was a violinist, and he just understood the instrument inside out, really.
Yeah. Well, here is another composer who obviously understands this instrument inside out. I think one of the great instrumental concertos, period, written in the last three decades. Here is the violin concerto, finished in 1989, the violin concerto by Lionel Sainsbury, performed by violinist Lorraine McCaslin and the BBC Concert Orchestra, led by Barry Wordsworth. Concerto by Lionel Sainsbury in a performance by violinist Lorraine McCaslin. The BBC Concert Orchestra was conducted by Barry Wordsworth. And I believe in the introduction I said led by, and of course British orchestras are led by the first violinist, who in this country we call the concertmaster. So if someone's listening in Old Blighty, there might have been a little confusion.
So we live and learn something every day.
Right, right. Or as Bernard Shaw said, we are two peoples divided by a common language.
That's it. That's it.
Well, we're spending part of this Thursday evening with the English composer Lionel Sainsbury here on 91.5 Classical KUSC, Los Angeles. Well, why don't we round out the hour with something from the most recent recording of your music, the album called Sunlight and Storms, with which you were very closely involved, I think it's fair to say.
Well, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
It's an album of your piano music played by you.
All recorded during 2013 and just released in May of this year.
Yeah, yeah. And you began studying the piano as a little kid.
Yeah, I mean, I'd always played the piano. In England, we sometimes say from knee high.
Yes.
But my first serious lessons were while I was at school. There was a visiting teacher who came in, whose name was Margaret Brown. And she was actually very far-sighted in that she would encourage me to learn things by rote at the keyboard without insisting that I learn to read, because at that time I still didn't read. And we learned things such as the Chopin Etude, Opus 10, Number 1, and the so-called Ocean Study, which is the Opus 25, Number 12, in that way. And they're pieces that follow a very clear pattern, so she was able to just teach me a little bit each week and gradually wore down my resistance to learning to read music.
Exactly. Well, maybe a word about Incantation.
Yeah, Incantation was written in 1998. It's a piece that actually I think has been quite influenced by Chopin in many ways, particularly in the structure of the piece. If you think of some of the Chopin nocturnes that follow a similar kind of pattern, where you have a very, very reflective, very calm, sometimes even quite tense outer sections, framing a kind of a very virtuoso, very fiery outburst in the middle section. So there's the most extreme contrast that you can possibly imagine. I think that's the kind of idea that's probably influenced me very much in my own piece, Incantation.
We'll hear from that new Navona record CD called Sunlight and Storms, piano music of Lionel Sainsbury, who's the composer's Opus 26. Here is Incantation, played by the composer. Music from 1998, the piano piece called Incantation, performed on that recent Navona record CD by the composer Lionel Sainsbury. Now, you studied composition at the Guildhall School with a man that we'd lost just a couple of months ago, and a man who, in spite of the fact that he wrote six symphonies, is a man without whom Christmas really wouldn't be Christmas, I don't think. We wear out Patrick Stanford's Christmas Carol Symphony on this station during the Christmas season. What was he like to study with?
Patrick Stanford was the most wonderful human being. He really was the most incredibly lovely man. I'm very, very sad indeed to have only heard actually a couple of weeks ago. He passed away suddenly in April at the age of 75. And my sessions with him really consisted in a kind of stimulating exploration of music rather than any kind of formalized procedures. And he really allowed me to steer my own course and find my own way musically. And that's something that I'm really very, very, very grateful for. And as you say, I mean, his first symphony, The Seasons, really deserves to be much better known. And that's actually recently been released in a British Music Society recording with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra. And I would urge people to hear it. It's a brilliant representation of its subject. It's a little in the line of the similarly descriptive pieces of Holst, such as The Planets, obviously, and the Perfect Fool. Absolutely outstanding orchestral piece.
Yeah, yeah. And it was through him, and given the fact you also won the Mendelssohn Prize, that you met the great English symphonist Edmund Rubra, who has really yet to find his audience, but I think one of the great symphonists of the 20th century.
I'm a particular admirer of the Fifth.
Yeah.
I just met him for one afternoon, way back in, I think it was 1981. He was an extremely modest man, and he was very encouraging to me, and he made some very pertinent observations about my early efforts.
Yeah, and actually I'm very fond of the Sixth Symphony, if for no other reason that in the Scherzo, there's one bar of xylophone. because he wanted a xylophone right there. And yeah, the xylophone plays and then goes away and never comes back. I mean, that is a kind of integrity and purity of purpose that you
Yeah, well, and those are very good words to describe him. I mean, he was a man of great integrity. And I'd actually also hoped to meet Samuel Barber at that time in the wake of having won that scholarship in 1980. And as you may know, Barber came over to Scotland for his last visit to Minotti at that time, I think in the summer of 1980. And I got in touch with Shermer's, the publishers, to see if there was any chance of meeting him, but I think his state of health was, shall we say, grave.
Oh, yeah, he was dying at that point.
Absolutely, sure. But sure. I would dearly love to have met him.
Well, I certainly won't ask you, what is an Englishman doing writing all of these tangos? Because I know the answer.
The tangos date from 2009, 2010. But recently, earlier this year, I did visit Argentina and had a pretty amazing experience of playing my own tangos to an Argentine audience, which, as you can imagine, was a fairly daunting experience. But I needn't have worried, actually. They're an incredibly musical people, an incredibly warm people. And they're just so enthusiastic about serious music concerts because the genuine tango is so prevalent over there. I think that they really have a hunger for other things as well. And a so-called serious classical concert is something they clearly relished. But I think my own tangos are probably as much influenced by North American music, perhaps a touch of Gershwin and again Barber, even elements of the blues, and of course Piazzolla. They're influenced by all those things perhaps as much as by pure Argentine tango.
Well, as they certainly deserve to do. Here are the five tangos, Opus 34 by Lionel Sainsbury. The recent Avantgarde CD called Sunlight and Storms, the five tangos of Lionel Sainsbury, played by the composer. Tangos, Opus 34 by Lionel Sainsbury, performed on that recent Navona record CD by the composer himself. We're spending a good part of this Thursday evening with the composer Lionel Sainsbury, who's joined us tonight from his home in Oxfordshire. Here on 91.5 Classical KUSC Los Angeles, the member-supported broadcast service of the University of Southern California. Well, in the CMR CD, you go up against some pretty heavy competition, to wit the violin sonatas of Ivor Gurney and Sir Edward Elgar. And I have to say, your 7.5-minute soliloquy for solo violin holds up very well, even against those two. And I'm not only an Elgar freak, I am a total Ivor Gurney freak.
Well, you must have been in seventh heaven with this scene.
Oh, absolutely. Ivor Gurney, and as we were talking, as we were listening to the five tangos, it's one of those stories that would make a wonderful movie if Hollywood made movies about serious musicians anymore or any sort of serious subject anymore.
Yes, it's such an incredible and tragic life, as you say. I mean, it really would lend itself.
A hugely gifted guy who was both a superb composer and a superb poet.
Yeah, he was.
And who was gassed and shell-shocked during the Great War and never really recovered.
Yeah, no, indeed. Indeed.
Now, the soliloquy for solo violin has been recorded twice so far.
Yeah, there are two recordings, and I must say, actually, I'm delighted with both of them. They're very, very different performances, and it's been fascinating for me to have them both and compare them both. There's the one by Rupert Marshall Luck. That's on the English Music Records label, which is the arm of the English Music Festival here in England. And there's another recording on a disc called Slices, which is with Navona Records in New Hampshire. And the violinist on that recording is a Czech violinist called Vít Muzík. and he gives a great performance of the piece as well. He really does. Very, very different from Rupert's, and fascinating to compare.
Yeah, yeah, and like so much of your music, this piece seems to be about something much more than notes on the page, if you know what I mean.
I would hope so.
Yeah, I mean... but of course, all music is, you know, precisely measurable quantities and intervals and durations and so forth. Your music seems to always want to carry some large emotional burdens, and this piece does too. Is it something you can actually discuss? I mean, it's not fair to ask a composer.
I wouldn't use the word burdens, but certainly I think that, if you like, my artistic credo in a way might be that music should have emotion at its core, or an emotional message. And in fact, Rupert's Marshall Luck has written a very interesting note, which you may have read in the liner notes for that disc.
Exactly. The unaccompanied status of the violin, as well as the work's title, sets up an expectation in the mind of the listener. And indeed, the work's emotional tenor is redolent of some of Shakespeare's monologues. The declamatory dramatic manner is contrasted with a more intimate lyrical color, in just the same way that, for example, the eponymous character's soliloquy opens Richard III as both a public presentational aspect, now is the winter of our discontent and so forth, and an introspective, inward-looking tone, during which the listener is taken into the character's confidence. Well, here is the soliloquy for solo violin by Lionel Sainsbury, performed by violinist Rupert Marshall Luck. Performance by violinist Rupert Marshall Luck, who also supplies the insightful liner notes for that EMR recording. That was the soliloquy for solo violin by Lionel Sainsbury, who is my guest on this Thursday evening here on 91.5 Classical KUSC Los Angeles, the member-supported broadcast service of the University of Southern California. So how long did your actual instruction in the piano continue?
Well, as I think I mentioned earlier, I had some early lessons when I was at school with Margaret Brown. And I then went to the Guildhall School of Music, where I studied composition with Patrick Stanford and piano with Edith Vogel. And I think the most important thing I really got from her was thinking about the importance of fingering, or the importance of thinking about fingering, which is something, you know, I benefit from that to this day. And it's something that I hadn't really thought about that much before then. But I have to say, her relationships with her pupils were often somewhat stormy. She could be didactic, but she had a great deal to offer. And as I say, that is really, I think, the main thing that I came away with, which is, it may sound quite trivial, but actually it's quite an important aspect of preparing the things that you play.
Fingering in what sense? Just the actual fingering in various pieces, or?
What I mean by fingering is deciding, you know, which fingers you're going to use to play a given passage. Sometimes it's not always that clear cut. Sometimes there are many more than one way of playing a passage, and it's giving that thought to what works best that I think is very important.
Sure. Sure. Well, I don't really hear the spirit of Franz Schubert hovering over your Moments Musicaux. Why this title?
I think it's quite intriguing to me, actually, that although it's a French title, the two famous examples, which of course are by Schubert and Rachmaninoff, neither of them are French.
Exactly.
And as far as I know, no French composer has used the title. I just thought, well, maybe it's time that an Englishman used it.
Oh, why not? Why not? It sounds like a very tough piece to play. I mean, this is not salon music. by any stretch of the imagination.
I must say, actually, they are quite demanding, some of the pieces, certainly. To play them all in one go is quite something.
Yeah. So there are 10 of them in all. Were they conceived as a set?
I think not exactly, Jim, but I think they quickly started to formulate as a set. I think after I'd written a few of them, these were in 2003 I wrote these pieces, I think I began to conceive of them as a set quite quickly. But as you probably know, they're fairly diverse, and they reflect a lot of my various influences, really. I mean, there's one that is steeped in the world of the flamencos of Andalusia in southern Spain before, and there's one which is a very lazy kind of habanera, which is number 5.
So in other words, like so many English composers before you, most notably Sir Edward Elgar, you take a lot of pleasure and sustenance from what used to be called in the South.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Although I've been to Argentina, I haven't actually been to Spain. And people often remark on that with some surprise. And I think that some of my inverted commas Spanish pieces, they're perhaps inspired by more by imagination, like a general, even idealized feel, and particularly for that flamenco tradition. I was very interested by the description by art historian Matthew Collings, I heard recently on a television program, actually, talking about Turner. He said that in some of Turner's paintings, he was interested in a poetic past. And I think, you know, that struck quite a chord with me.
I'll bet. We'll hear from that recent Navona Records CD of piano music by Lionel Sainsbury, the album called Sunlight and Storms, are the 10 Moments Musicaux, Opus 31, played by the composer. Including with one that sounds like a genuine handful. The 10 Moments Musicaux, Opus 31, by Lionel Sainsbury. That performance from a recent Navona Records CD called Sunlight and Storms. The 10 Moments Musicaux by Lionel Sainsbury, played by the composer. Well, to begin the final hour of this evening's program, we're going to hear work that I think certainly ranks with the Lionel Sainsbury Violin Concerto, which is to say one of the great cello concertos of the last 3 decades. Now, your cello concerto followed the violin concerto by about a decade, and it sounds like an inane thing to say, but I think the two things that they have in common, and I think the only two things they have in common, they were written for a big stringed instrument, and they were both written by you. They are very different works, as I think we're going to hear.
Yeah, I think they probably are, yeah. I think they do share a certain structural similarities, but I think in terms of their character, they are very different.
Yeah, and especially in the outer movements of the cello concerto, I hear a lot of jazz and a lot of blues, and actually what sound like references to Black American spirituals, especially in the finale. Was that conscious or...?
Not at all conscious, no. When I was rehearsing the concerto with Raphael Valfish, who, as you know, is the superb soloist on the disc, his daughter actually is a jazz singer, and he said, you know, I think I really should be getting some tuition from my daughter on this.
Really?
But the cellist Alban Gerhardt has also played through the concerto with me, and he also, just as you have, referred to that theme as being like a spiritual, if it's the theme that I think you're referring to in the last movement.
Yeah.
And I thought, what a great description, because it hadn't occurred to me myself.
Yeah, I think that's sort of an illustration of a point that I think a lot of people have made over the years, is that often the best things in any music are the things that are completely unconscious and things that come up out of sources that no one can really explain, least of all the composer himself.
Yes, I mean, very often people will sort of point out something to me, and that's a case in point, you know, that theme is perhaps very like a spiritual, and I'll find I'm saying, oh yes, so it is, but it was not something that I had in mind, it was not a conscious aim. I mean, equally, people will sometimes point out influences of certain other composers, and sometimes those will be things that I haven't actually been conscious of either.
Yeah, this is something that I think one of the symptoms that your music is extremely important in that. I don't really hear much in the way of influence from anyone. I know there are lots of composers you adore, but I don't really hear any Walton, for instance, in any of your stuff. And I don't hear Elgar, and I don't really hear, well, much of anyone else.
Well, that's very interesting you should say that. I mean, I think as regards the two concertos, I think the influence of Walton, actually, and Elgar, is probably much stronger in the violin concerto. I wonder who you think the influences in the cello concerto are.
In the cello concerto, and I don't mean this in any musical sense, because it doesn't resemble it at all musically, but in terms of... And again, you know, you get into areas that if you're talking about it too long, it sounds like you're talking complete stuff and nonsense. But the concerto that it most reminds me of in terms of its depth and in terms of what it seems to be doing emotionally is the Finzi cello concerto, which I think is, you know, one of the great 20th century cello concertos.
Yeah, quite a few people have drawn comparisons with Finzi, actually, and it's not something I feel myself. I mean, I admire the Finzi concerto, but it's certainly not a piece that I feel has influenced me.
And speaking of Finzi, have you considered writing for any wind instruments? I think that's the great modern clarinet concerto, the one written by Gerald Finzi. Have you ever been tempted to think about writing...
Yes, no, that's an outstanding piece. Not a concerto, no, but I have actually written some clarinet pieces, some early pieces of mine that I... Some of my early pieces that I do still acknowledge, a piece called Prelude, Blues and Postlude for clarinet and piano, which currently hasn't actually been recorded. It was recently played by Anna Hashimoto, a brilliant young Japanese clarinetist. So that's my sort of contribution to the clarinet, shall we say.
Yeah, well, a new clarinet concerto would always be welcome. All my clarinet friends tell me so.
Uh-huh. Well, I take that on board.
Well, here is that Dutton recording of the Cello Concerto, Opus 27, music from 1999 by Lionel Sainsbury. Raphael Wolfish is the cellist. The Royal Scottish National Orchestra is led by Martin Yates. Cello Concerto, music from 1999 by Lionel Sainsbury, performed on that Dutton CD by cellist Raphael Wolfish and the Royal Scottish National Orchestra, led by Martin Yates. We've been spending a big chunk of this Thursday evening with the composer Lionel Sainsbury here on 91.5 Classical KUSC Los Angeles, the member-supported broadcast service of the University of Southern California. Well, you live in a very picturesque corner of Great Britain, and does the fact that you live out there in Oxfordshire, rural Oxfordshire, sort of help or hinder the kind of music you write, or is it completely irrelevant?
Oh, I think it helps it. I mean, I live in a beautifully isolated spot, so it's beautifully quiet. There's a minimum of disturbances, which is very necessary for your work.
Yeah, and London is, you know, just down the M, whatever one it is.
It's the M40, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, you know, you can get to London in pretty much 2 hours. So, very well placed.
Yeah. Well, I think you probably agree with me, and you probably agree with one of our best composers, John Carignano, who says that the days when composers had to seriously worry about pleasing each other and writing the kind of music that seems to be designed only to be ingested by other composers are long gone. And the days when writing music that so obviously is directed at other human beings, it's a perfectly okay thing to do now, when, you know, for a long time it wasn't.
Well, I would certainly hope so, Jim. I think, you know, modern, contemporary, classical music, however we want to describe it, has been through some very problematic times. And actually, I was struck by an interview I heard several years ago now with another one of your composers, John Adams. He was referring to, you know, like dinner parties that he would be invited to, where there'd be lively, sort of informed discussion about all of the other modern arts, say, theatre, cinema, poetry, novels, or, you know, obviously visual art. And yet when it came to modern music, he said everyone, even in those gatherings, simply pleaded ignorance. And I like to think that, you know, hopefully we might be moving beyond that now.
Well, yeah, yeah. And for so many years, it's a pretty sore subject, but in the days, say, when Sir William Glock ran the BBC, and thus the BBC Proms concerts, so many wonderful composers were thrown under the bus, basically, because they didn't do second Viennese school-inspired stuff. And no one is more enthusiastic about that kind of music than I am. But that's not the only kind of music there was. And for a generation and a half, some wonderful English composers had to think about doing other things. George Lloyd, for instance. Mm. Who for 20 years was a market gardener, supported himself and his wife, yeah, by raising mushrooms and carnations because no one would play his music.
Yeah, yeah.
That seems to be changing these days.
Well, I certainly hope so. I certainly hope so.
Well, just keep at it, because you've obviously got the hang of this stuff. And I'd love to see an English horn concerto down the road somewhere.
I'm making notes.
I'm not trying to twist your arm by any means. Lionel Sainsbury, thanks so much for stopping in this evening.
Great pleasure to have been with you, Jim. Thank you very much.
Well, here to conclude is the Meditation, Opus 28, by Lionel Sainsbury, played by the composer.